Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, what's up, America? It's Michael Steele. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. It's such a treat to have you guys with us. Really appreciate the love you've shown the podcast. We're growing and expanding, and it's all because you like to download. We appreciate that very much. Of course, you get me on all the fun spots, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast on. Well, you know, this has been in American politics one hell of a week, and I'm excited about the brother I got coming on today to talk about it. He is none other than Kurt Bardella, a Morning Joe and NBC News Think contributor, as well as a member of USA Today's Board of Contributors. Kurt, if you guys have seen him around town and certainly on air, you know a little bit about him. He's worked as the spokesperson and senior advisor for Republicans on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee under the leadership of Representative Daryl Issa. That must have been a hoot. Prior to working at the committee, right? Kurt served as the spokesperson for Senator Olympia Snowe, who I get the pleasure of serving on the bipartisan Policy Center's board with her. She's a great lady. And before that, for Representative Brian Bilbray. And following the 2016 election, Kurt did the unthinkable, the unspeakable. He left the Republican Party to join the Democratic Party. Kurt, welcome to the podcast, baby.
Hey, my man. Thanks for having me on.
It is a great treat. Look, Kurt and I ran into each other after appearances in the green room and looked at each other and said, yeah, we got to make this happen.
Come on. Everyone's talking about your podcast. It's always blowing up. Like, how's this guy not have me on yet? Come on.
Well, we made the magic happen, and I'm glad you're here. Before we get into all the good stuff of this week, which was the amazing consolidation by Joe Biden in the Democratic primary, I want to get a little bit of background on you for the folks who are listening, because a lot of folks oftentimes see these pretty faces and hear these names and listen to these, you know, guys like you and me, but don't really know too much about our walk. And one of the things that I really appreciate about your specific walk, you wrote a piece a little while back in 2018, and one thing that stood out to me was where you went personal. You said, on a personal level, one of the biggest changes for me has been how I view issues of race. I spent the bulk of my life avoiding race. My first name is German. My last name is Italian. And I was born in Seoul, South Korea. I'm adopted. And as an adopted kid myself, that struck an immediate chord, because I could tap into that walk for you, not just along the racial lines, but just along the who am I identity lines. How do I fit into this space? You know, there is a family out there that's not a family. There's a lineage and a heritage that's not, I'm not really connected to, other than being, you know, Asian. How has that been for you in terms of establishing Kurt Bardella?
You know, it's so funny. You realize this now, you know, once you're at a point in your life where you're comfortable with who you are and, you know, you have life experience. But I spent so much of my life and my youth, I think, not wanting to be defined by the way that I look, because, you know, every conversation that you have with someone for the first time, they look at you kind of awkwardly. It's like, wait a second, your name's Kurt Bardella. You speak perfect English, but you don't look like we thought you would. What's up with that? And, you know, after having had that conversation, more times than I can remember, for me, it almost became a defense mechanism to not want to be associated with any race or any name or lineage. Just I am who I am, and none of that matters.
Right.
And particularly with a family dynamic where it's like, well, my family is the people who have loved me, who have raised me, who have invested their time and energy in me. As we know in this day and age, anybody can have a kid, but raising a kid, loving a kid, being there, that's a different story.
Yeah.
And I never wanted that part of my life defined by what I looked like. And so I almost, as a defense mechanism, pushed away any connotation to my South Korean lineage. And what started happening, though, was much later on, as I started doing TV and speaking out the way that I have, a number of people would reach out to me who are Asian Americans and who are very thankful that there was someone who looked like them who was doing what I was doing. And,
right.
and you start and you kind of look around and take an inventory and you realize, you know what? There aren't that many people
there
who
aren't.
Look like me that are
no.
out there in TV land.
There really
aren't. And that it. And it struck me how much it meant to people that someone that looked like them could be out there doing this. And as I talked to a lot of those folks, especially young students who are in college, who are coming of age, and they were inspired by what I was doing, I realized that, you know, it's time for me to embrace that part of my life to to really accept the responsibility that comes with being a visible person and to try to in any way use that to draw attention to issues that affect, you know, the Asian American community and try to be a symbol, someone that can tell them that, yeah, you can speak your mind and find a platform that will help you deliver that message to as many people as possible and be an instrument of change.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of folks, particularly for men of color like ourselves, who come from the adopted space, people don't appreciate how much extra weight you carry because you when you walk in the room, folks see an Asian man, and then therefore they start projecting and they start assuming and they start and you're like,
mm-hmm.
I may or may not have a full-throated connection to all of that because I am adopted. I wasn't raised necessarily in an Asian environment or
right.
an Asian home. So the expectation that I'm clued in, like, yeah, I didn't get to go to the meeting on Sunday because I wasn't
That's
invited.
Right.
But a lot of people assume you're automatically in that pipeline. And it is an extra layer of baggage, if you will, you got to carry. And then you've got to unpack it for people to help them understand, yeah, my first name's German, my last name's Italian, I'm of Asian heritage. What does that say? You know? So
right.
I'm coming not just from one bucket. I got three buckets that I'm playing in. So it's different.
Well, and it's like that dreaded question of, you know, when people ask you, where are you from? And then for me, I always respond, well, I grew up in San Diego and I was raised in upstate New York. And then they would go, well, where is your family from? And it's like, well, they're from the upstate New York. And you know what they're trying to get at.
Yes.
And bless their heart, they don't understand why that is somewhat inappropriate. Like, their intention is good.
Right.
They mean well.
Exactly.
But I'll tell you, white folk who ask you that, you're like, you know, you're asking if I'm Chinese, Japanese,
right.
or something else.
That's what
you're really asking.
That's what they want to get to. I can look at your face, but I just can't tell, and I don't want to be wrong, you know? And you're like, God bless you, you know? It's like I get all the time.
Exactly.
It's hysterical because my parentage is mixed. So I've got a lot of Middle Eastern, you know, facial features because I don't have, the African nose and the cheekbone.
Sure.
So people look at you and go, well, are you Egyptian or are you Ethiopian? I'm like, nah, fool, I'm black. What the hell? What do you want? What are you asking me here? But it is amazing how people just kind of dance around that around these issues and put the baggage on you, and then you've got to unpack it for them, and it becomes, you know, cumbersome after a while. You're just like, look, I'm Kurt, you know, and you know if I want to get into my narrative, I'll get into it with you, but just, you know, until then, let's move on to something else.
Right, right.
So it's kind of funny. Well, speaking of moving on. So that is part of your foundational formation, and a lot of people made a big deal about your move away from the party, Republican Party in 16, particularly given the spaces in which you've worked, you know, working for Darrell Issa and the various Republican committees and being all up in that. What I want to get into, what drew you in the first place? Because the leaving is the hardest part, and I don't think people appreciate that so much because everyone thinks, oh, I can just get up and go because these guys piss me off. It's not that easy because it's linked to the thing that awakened inside of you to say, hey, I want to self-identify in the first instance as a Republican
right.
or as a conservative or as fill in the blank. What was that journey for you?
No, for me, the political awareness came kind of in that post 9/11 world. You know, I was 17 or 18 years old when 9/11 happened, and you know, and through the eyes of a teenager, being a Republican, you know, there was a direct link to in my mind at the time to patriotism, and to the themes of freedom and liberty and homeland security. You know, and I think people now can easily forget what it was like in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 and how scary that was for everybody. And here we had these kind of iconic moments of people like President George W. Bush in New York City standing on that pile of rubble.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And no matter what you think of his politics, what would happen after, that was an iconic American moment and left a very big impression on me. And I was, you know, and at the same time as that's going on, I had the opportunity to intern for my local state, California State Assembly member, who happened to be a Republican. So from a very early age, fresh out of high school, I was kind of right there in the middle of Republican politics in California. Now, mind you, Republican politics in California are very different than Republican politics in Alabama or Arkansas or Oklahoma. It's a much more moderate edge, as you can imagine, California being what it is. And so that was my introduction, really, to politics, was that experience, you know, both nationally, what was going on with the war on terror, and then for me personally, working in this local office, and you know, in a very progressive state where most of the Republicans in that case were very moderate, and who and who in today's politics don't even exist anymore. And I think a lot of people don't realize this, but in politics, once you kind of pick your team, that's your team. It is almost unheard of and impossible to switch teams later on. Our entire professional identities are wrapped up in that team that we belong to. Our entire financial future is tied to being on that team. And you know, I was very fortunate that I had a lot of great mentors, people who saw something in me and gave me opportunities to advance professionally, even though I hadn't gone to college. I went straight out of high school into this job in the state legislature and kept having opportunities presented to me. And which led me to the path that brought me to D.C. in 2006. We won a very contested congressional race from a race in San Diego, again, a very moderate area. Where issues like clean water and clean beaches are very important and things that as Republicans you talk about. And we won that race. And the next day I had been 22 at the time that the congressman elect, you know, called me and asked me if I wanted to go to D.C. and be his press secretary. And then I was kind of off and running from there.
It's interesting because your entry point is, it sounds not so, was it philosophically oriented as much as it was just opportunities to sort of be in the state? Did you have like I know for me, as a young man of 17, getting ready to vote in my first election, literally 3 weeks after my 18th birthday, that fall, the Reagan mystique captured me. When he ran in 76, and it was like, wow, this guy sounds like my mom. And my mom was a Roosevelt Democrat, which actually makes sense because so was Reagan in many respects before he became a Republican. And so that sort of set the philosophical orientation for me. What was the philosophical orientation? Because you don't strike me as a Darrell Issa kind of Republican.
No.
And so it just, so I know that's job. That was opportunity. That was, okay, hey, we want you to work on, or you saw the opportunity to serve on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. What philosophically, because I think the philosophical orientation is going to be important for my next question. So
sure.
I want to give you a chance to sort of lay that stone for us.
Well, there were a couple of things that really spoke to me at this period of time. You know, first, again, you know, the emphasis on just national security, homeland security, realizing that we are facing a very different world than the one that existed pre 9/11.
Right.
And it seemed to me that the Republican Party was best equipped at having that, leading that conversation in a lot of ways. I think for me, the idea of you know, this, it's, again, it's so funny to think about now, but this was a party that preached, you know, fiscal discipline and living within your means and balanced budgets,
right,
and you know, the principles of how a functioning government should actually operate. The idea that bureaucracy is inherently wasteful and that there is waste, fraud, abuse, mismanagement that needs to be weeded out, and that the bigger the government gets, the harder it is to do that.
Right.
The idea that limited government, ensures that we have more individual freedom. Those were all principles that were, I think, huge tenets of Republican orthodoxy at the time that I subscribed to.
So why that's important for me to understand, and I hope for the folks who are listening right now, is in your piece in 2018, you wrote a very interesting passage for me, sentence, and it was, quote, "Being a Democrat is a heck of a lot more emotionally exhausting than being a Republican was, because I care about a lot more things than I used to." So I guess the question I have is, what does that mean? Is that you care a lot more, or does it mean that there is more room inside the Democratic Party to care more openly about these things that you care about? Because philosophically, because I get all the time, oh, well, why don't you become a Democrat? Well, because for me, I can't turn off philosophically what moved me to be a Republican. As I identify mm-hmm. as a Lincoln Republican specifically, I don't see that necessarily reflected philosophically in the Democratic Party. I care a lot about a lot of issues that, as I pushed as a candidate and an elected official, and certainly as a party leader at the local, state, and national levels, that were edged up against where Republicans basically stood, I still mm-hmm. talked about those things and got slammed, obviously, a lot for that. But I'm like, screw you. This is the philosophy that brought me in. In fact, identifies more with Ronald Reagan than you do. So I'm trying to mm-hmm. understand from your transition, into the Democratic Party, when you say that you could care a lot more about things, what does that mean?
One of the things that I realized, and actually I have to credit my wife a lot for this, because it was, my wife couldn't have been any more different than I was when we met.
Right.
She grew up in the Bay Area. She's a lifelong, progressive Democrat. And it was in having conversations with her about issues like climate change, issues
right.
like, equality for women, things that, frankly, as a Republican, I just never thought about and talked about. Like, this was not part of the daily social conversation I was having with my friends and in my Republican uh-huh. circles. I just didn't have any formed opinions about them, because I just never talked or thought about them. And in having conversations with her, I realized, like, wow, I never thought about this. I never thought about it from that perspective. I don't agree with this. And there are enough times that you say that you realize, wow, I'm pretty ignorant about some things. And it turns out, where I fall on those issues are completely not in alignment with the Republican Party. And it was her who kind of made the observation, in all the conversations that we've had, 90% of the time you agree with where the Democrats are. Why are you a Republican? And that really is kind of what started the conversation internally for me. That, coupled with what was happening externally with the Republican Party, with the rise of Trumpism and ultimately the Trump takeover of the Republican Party, and seeing so many people turn their backs from the things that they profess to believe in for so long, it got to a point for me where I was just done, and I needed to be come to terms, no matter what the professional fallout, public fallout may have been, with the reality that, you know what, I just don't align with this party.
She helped you find your inner Democrat.
She really did. I mean, she would say,
do that,
5 years of crying about polar bears, but it finally happened.
No, that to me is important, because I think, you know, again, as I said before we started getting into it, a lot of times people see these things happen with people that they know, where one day you're playing on this team, the next day you're playing on that team, and they're like, well, okay, so what does that mean? And I think it's important for people to understand, a lot of times these journeys are you know, self-fulfilling, self-awareness, a gradual motivations that kind of come into focus. But they are at all times where events, external events, in this case, political party oriented, move away from you, and you see, wait a minute, I don't want to go where that's going, because that's not where my orientation is. And we get caught up. It's real easy to say, oh, well, Kurt is anti-Trump or Michael is anti-Trump. Well, no. It's much more to it. I mean, it's easy to be anti-Trump. Shit, you can do that all damn day. In fact, we see it. That's not the most complicated thing in the world to do, because he makes it so friggin' easy. The more complicated and more insightful part of this is understanding why you make those breaks. And just as I say, hey, I'm the guy who's still on the front porch, who's like the Motel 6 with the light on, right? And there, for me, there's a there's a philosophical reason for that, as well as a political one. And I think it's important for people to not cheapen your journey and experience, because particularly among some assholish Republicans who, you know, like to throw around rhino bullshit and all of that and say, oh, well, you're just a rhino. Well, dude, you don't get to define my Republicanism, because I've been in this game probably longer than you've been alive. So, you know, the fact that if that's your go-to tells me more about your insecurities as a Republican than my journey or Kurt's journey as individuals, and, you know, who have a stronger anchor. So,
and I think, you know, and I for one am thankful that there are people like you who haven't left the Republican Party, because I believe that this country functions best when we have two strong parties that actually have a moral center at them. And at some point, I hope this period of Trumpism will come to an end. And when that does, we're going to need people like you to rebuild what's been torn down. And, you know, and maybe we'll get to a point that they may, that maybe that won't be possible someday. I don't know.
Right.
But I still believe that it might be. And as long as there's a chance for that, it's important that there are those who stay Republicans, who believe in what traditional Republicans have believed before Trump ever came along. And because the answer isn't, well, we should all be Democrats and Democratic Party should just wipe out the Republican Party forever. That's not good either.
Right.
You have to have balance. You have to have balance so that you can actually achieve compromise in public policy. And, you know, it's like, I have friends and many of them, you know, from Michael Singleton to people like Kara Sattmeyer, who we talk about this amongst ourselves. And I tell them, like, I know it's hard. And people ask them all the time, like, you, why are you still a Republican? How can you stand and have that name next year's? And I applaud that. I think that it's brave. The easy thing to do at this point would be to walk away, I feel like, because of all the toxicity surrounding the Republican brand. But there is going to be a day after Trump. And when that day comes, people like you guys are going to be really important.
Lord Jesus, can't come fast enough. Anyway, as Kurt and I get up off the couch here, we're going to take a quick break. Because I got a couple of sponsors who'd like to say some nice things to you. Appreciate you guys.
Got to pay some bills, man.
I got to pay some bills. Appreciate you guys listening. We're going to have more with my buddy Kurt Bardella right after this. All right, everybody, welcome back. As I said, we're talking with good brother, Kurt Bardella, Morning Joe and NBC News Think contributor, guy who's made the journey. And if you just tuning in, rewind this and listen to the first part of this, because when we have the next conversation, a lot of stuff's going to make some sense, because now you understand where the brother's coming from. Kurt, what the hell happened this week? I mean,
wow.
Bernie Sanders was like, oh, the fait accompli, the nominee of the Democratic Party. And the one thing that struck me about everything that happened were the words of Joe Biden, not a week ago, not 2 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago, but 4 or 5 months ago, when he said, South Carolina, just wait for South Carolina.
Yep.
What happened, brother?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that happened was black people actually got to vote in this election. So
imagine
far,
this is what happened when we get the franchise,
yet.
Right?
I mean, you know, it's so asinine to watch through Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, these narratives be set in stone when the only people who had voted at that point were predominantly white.
Right.
And, you know, it should not have come to a surprise to anyone that South Carolina was going to be very different. You know, now, I don't think anybody expected the rapid acceleration of Biden's resurrection, you know, to happen the way that it did, with people dropping out, coalescing. I mean, I watched it unfold, and I couldn't help but think to myself, gee, I wonder what Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz are thinking right now, because they're watching what should have happened for them in 2016. That imagine what the world would look like if they had actually had gotten their shit together and realized there can only be one of us that can go up against Trump. And if we don't unify and coalesce, it's going to be him. And who the hell knows what happens after that. Democrats got it right this time. They realized if we don't do what we need to do right now and narrow the field and get behind somebody, we're going to have the same thing happen to us that happened to those Republicans in 2016. So finally, the grown-ups seem to get together, face some hard facts. And I credit Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar and now even Elizabeth Warren for having that. It is not easy. And you know this, having had your name on the ballot, having been elected, it is not easy to walk away in the middle of the fight when there's still fight left in you.
Oh,
things
no.
That you believe
no.
in. That is the hardest thing to do in politics. And yet these people all did the right thing for the greater good, so that Biden can have a chance at being the nominee and having that coalescing effect and being best positioned in a position of strength to go up against Donald Trump.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot of people had been saying, and certainly have been saying for a while, where's Obama? Where's Obama? Where I think you saw the fingerprints of Barack Obama on the Buttigieg, Klobuchar, step aside. I would not be surprised when the book is written that there's a paragraph that talks about the president calling them and saying now's the time. Yes, he hasn't come out and forcefully endorsed his vice president. Yes, he's kind of been aloof in this process, and even some of his people were working for the other guy, if you will. But at the end of the day, I think when they saw the threat that having a Bernie Sanders as the national nominee for the party, they were like, okay, let me make a phone call and talk to some folks. And I think, you know, certainly Jim Clyburn's very personal endorsement, just like Obama in Iowa in 2008, in 2020, South Carolina set the trend line that we're going to see play out over the rest of this campaign. And it is something that I think Democrats now recognize. They're not winning the presidency in 2020 without the black vote. It ain't happening. I don't care how you. Now, the dance I think they're going to have to figure out, Kurt, and I'd be curious what you think here, is I'm already beginning to hear, well, Biden's going to owe black people. Well, first off, that's the wrong attitude to have, because that's not how politics works at this level. You just can't. That's not a one for one. Well, I give to you, now you take care of me. So that's going to be number one. Number two, what does he owe and how does he pay it? is going to be a point of contention. And, of course, we're already talking about, well, he's got to put a black woman on the ticket. Well, okay, that universe is not that big, number one. You're really dealing with a narrow set of folks who can step in. And number two, the expectation, you've got to keep it realistic, is it's not just Joe Biden. It now becomes the rest of America who looks at this ticket and goes, okay, I buy Joe, but if they're not buying the vice presidential, that is a problem. And if you've got someone that they don't see as a potential president, that's an issue. So there are a whole lot of pieces here. I think you got to let Joe, first off, run the rest of his race, get to the primary, and then put him in a position, put himself in a position to run the rest of the campaign to win the general. How do you see these narratives now playing out, that the black vote has clearly solidified in such a way that it has propelled him to front runner status? But then on the back end, you're already beginning to hear people say, well, you owe us now.
I mean, first, I think when the story of this campaign is written someday, it's very possible that we write the line that Jim Clyburn may have single-handedly saved the Democratic Party from themselves.
I think that's true.
By doing what he did.
Yeah.
That was a monumental moment that changed the entire trajectory of this campaign. And as a Democrat, I can say I'm incredibly thankful that Mr. Clyburn had both the wisdom and the guts to go out there and do what he did, because it could not have been easy given where things stood at that time. There was a lot of uncertainty just a week, 10 days ago, where this race stood. Number two, I think that it gets, you know, the idea that people owe people something is inherently, I think, toxic, and it's the wrong way to approach this. You know, there's no question that Biden has a lot of gratitude to the African-American community for showing up for him, and hopefully they will continue to do so. But I don't think that you can also enumerate what that should translate to in terms of, well, what do you give them in return?
Right.
First of all, I don't think that it's one thing that you give. I think that it's an agenda that you can enact that can actually make these people's lives better, because for too long, African-Americans in this country have been marginalized, whether it's trying to just vote, as we've seen throughout, you know, places like Texas, where it's harder for people to vote, whether it's doing things about income inequality, whether it's doing things about criminal justice reform and how we deal with law enforcement. I think that if the African-American community is owed anything, it's a robust agenda that actually fixes issues that the African-American community has to deal with day in and day out in this country. I don't think that the solution to that is one person or one figure, one spot, where it looks like it's almost a token spot, with no substance behind it. I think that when it comes to the vice presidency, particularly, frankly, when you have, and this is true for Bernie Sanders as well, two candidates who are older, the most important criteria is who could take over the presidency if that were needed. That's number one. The second thing is who can actually help you become president. And when you look at the, you know, for all the talk about popular votes and who does well in national polls, there is an electoral college system in play, and you got to pick someone who can help you win in the places that you need to win to actually win this election.
Right.
And who that is and what that looks like, I don't know. But if you pick someone just because it's out of central casting and it checks the box and pays your tab, that's not a winning solution. That's not the way to do this.
I think that's smart. I think that's smart analysis. And but it's going to run up, as you know, Kurt, and unfortunately, you're going to have to dance with it a lot more than we will on the Republican side, being inside the Democratic Party. That's just going to be an emotional conflagration. It's just people are just going to get all bent out of shape about it as this thing begins to narrow. You referenced Elizabeth Warren, who dropped out of the Democratic presidential race today, and this is Thursday the 5th, I believe it is, and you know, did not have, she had the gravitas as a candidate, but did not have the performance at the ballot box in the 14 Super Tuesday states that were in play for her. Having lost her home state of Massachusetts, coming in what, third or fourth there?
Third
is just a bruiser.
I'd fire everybody that worked for me if I were her.
Just a bruiser. Just amazing how you lose your own backyard. What next for her? Does she endorse, you think? I'm not sure, but what do you think on that front? How tight is that Sanders-Warren alliance? Remember, Warren was a Republican, so a lot of people kind of forget that. She's got, I get all of the progressive stuff she's shouting now, but everyone has a root. It's like the first part of our conversation. I want people to understand the root of things. It's important because unless you cut that root off and pull it up out of the ground, that's still a part of your thinking. It may morph into something else, but there's some essence to it. And I just don't know how tightly aligned that's going to be. And I think that's a negotiation down the road. What's your thoughts on that whole Sanders, Warren, and what impact she can have, knowing that she held out an endorsement until there was a final nominee, Hillary Clinton, in 2016. She didn't endorse in the primary between Sanders and Clinton. So what's your thinking?
I think that, for her, the most impactful endorsement she can make is to get behind Biden. If she did that, it's over. This primary is over if she gets behind Biden.
That's true.
People assume, because of their rhetoric, that her base and her support is naturally aligned with Bernie Sanders.
Right.
So if she does the as expected thing, well, you don't really get a whole lot for that, frankly, because people are expecting you to do that. If she does nothing, that's kind of a rebuke of Bernie, frankly, because since everyone assumes she's behind Bernie, her not getting behind him would just be a de facto
win. That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. Hey, saying nothing is like crickets. Wait, we're waiting. We're waiting.
So it's like knowing that doing nothing is a rebuke of Bernie. It's like, if you're going to do that, you might as well just get behind Biden and get the benefit of that, politically speaking. She gets to play the role, perhaps, too, of a kingmaker now, because, again, she's the one person who can end this primary tomorrow if she got behind Biden.
Well, I think it's true to recognize, and this is another assumption which you touch on, a lot of people think that her base voters are going to line up automatically and go to Bernie. Well, the numbers don't show that. The second choice for roughly 35-40% of her base was Buttigieg and Klobuchar. So if they weren't voting for her, they were voting for one of those two. Then now that they're out and supporting Biden, I think your point is a relevant one, that at least 40%, if not 50% of her base would not go to Bernie Sanders to begin with. So she's not delivering all that she's got to deliver to Bernie in an endorsement to begin with, which is why I think in most scenarios she sits out and wait until there's a nominee and then sort of goes full-throated behind that person. Politically that and strategically, that makes sense. But I think you're right. Probably if the goal in the party right now is, and I really believe they want a nominee by April, that if that's the case, there's going to be a lot of internal pressure such that, the party can bring it, for her to do what you suggest, and that is come out in this by getting behind Biden. Bernie then has nowhere to go. He's on an island. And then the question becomes for his voters, do you just want to stay pissed off for the rest of the summer and into the fall and stay home and watch Donald Trump get reelected? Or do you want to do the smart thing and get out there and fight to get a Democrat elected president? And then you can focus, if you get this over by April, Kurt, then you can focus on the Senate, because you've already seen the Democratic candidate governor decided to run for, is now talking about running for the Senate.
In Montana, Steve Bullock?
Yeah, Steve Bullock, thank you. It's like, hey, if Biden's the guy, hey, I don't have a down ballot problem now. And
that's
Senate
right.
race suddenly looks not just palatable, but winnable.
Winnable
in Montana, as across well, as
and,
elsewhere,
and that's what doesn't get talked about enough here is for all the Green New Deals and Medicare for Alls and all the great things that everybody wants to do, you can't do it if you don't have not just a majority in the Senate, but a big majority in the Senate, frankly. And all you look at where all of the frontline Democrats who won Trump districts in 2018, there's a reason why none of them have gotten behind Bernie Sanders, you know, predominantly speaking. They've all sided with Biden. And I think that tells you the most about where they think their best chances are and why up to this point, until it's become clear that Biden is, you know, objectively the clear frontrunner right now, why people like Steve Bullock, who stood on the sidelines and waited, weren't sure what they would do because they didn't want to risk putting their name out there in an election where Bernie may have been at the top of the ballot. They think they would have lost.
Right.
This is going to be a hard-fought, nasty, ugly campaign, the likes of which we probably have never seen before, frankly. And the only way that Democrats have a chance of winning, not just the White House, but taking back the majority in the Senate, is if they get the internal fighting over as soon as possible and start aiming their fire and their time, their money, their strategy, their manpower at beating Trump and Republicans in November. That can't start soon enough for
them. You're going to have Michael Bloomberg, who's going to be a walking, talking super PAC for the Democratic Party, and who's already prepared to put $500 million in. I suspect he'll put $1 billion more into this race to defeat Trump, using third-party independent expenditure operations through the various legal channels. He set this thing up, and what people missed, I think, in what Mike Bloomberg did, and I just, it's not going out on a limb. I think it just makes sense. I don't think Mike Bloomberg really ever thought that this thing would be realized into a full-blown presidential race. I think what Mike Bloomberg did was, let me shock the system, number one, by getting in. Number two, wake the Biden team the hell up and get mm-hmm. them refocused. And number three, put in place an infrastructure that Barack Obama literally took with him through Obama for America and just kind of set outside the party, which is why the DNC doesn't have any cash flow. And put in place an infrastructure on the ground with offices, with personnel, et cetera, and cash to do the ads and the get out the vote efforts, the voter registration, and the other independent expenditures that the party and the campaign are going to be loath to do, because they've got to really focus strategically where and how they spend their money. So there's some real, and of course you got Bernie Sanders saying, well, I don't need his help, and watching him on Rachel Maddow when she raised this question, like, dude, are you that stupid? You know, that's my interpretation of what Rachel said, who said it much more intellectually sound than I just did. But yeah, dude, are you that stupid? This guy's going to spend $1 billion to help you get elected president, and you're going to tell him no? And Bernie was like, well, he can do whatever he wants with his money. I'm like, you are so freaking clueless right now. You should not be president. But
yeah,
I
no
digress.
Kidding, man. I mean, it's like, shocking as this may sound to people, this election is going to be expensive, and,
yes.
and each side's going to need every dollar they can get their hands on. And so this is not the time to be turning away money, no matter who it's coming from, frankly. But like I said, but setting that nonsense aside, Bloomberg has built basically a duplicate DNC operation
yeah.
for himself here
yeah.
that can operate much more effectively, much more efficiently, has the talent and the manpower. Really, at this point, DNC's job is to put the convention on and nothing else.
That's it.
And we've seen on both sides, you know, whether it's in the Republican side, any of these like Americans for Prosperity that were built up that played huge roles in helping Republicans win state legislative seats and putting boots on the ground and mobilizing grassroots voters and organizing in a way that the RNC wasn't able to do. I've been waiting for Democrats to wake up and realize, you know, no matter what you think of those groups, they're pretty freaking effective. So maybe it's time we built some of our own.
So the third leg of this campaign, you've got the Republican candidate, the Democratic candidate, and then you've got coronavirus. The coronavirus episode, which could long be over by the time we get through the summer and all that, but it will have a lasting impact. The way the administration has responded to it, the number of people who are infected with the virus, and then, of course, any further fatalities will have an impact. The president tweeted out today in the morning, quote, with approximately 100,000 coronavirus cases worldwide and 3,280 deaths, the United States, because of quick action on closing our borders, has, as of now, only 129 cases. 40 Americans brought it in. and 11 deaths. We are working very hard to keep these numbers as low as possible. This is the same person. And yes, this I'm not just taking this out of context. And yes, this is exactly what the president said, that this was another Democratic hoax. That's what he said. Go look it up. I'm not taking that out of context for those of you people who just wet your panties. And the fact of the matter is, this president thought this was a joke. He didn't take it seriously. He thought that it would not get here. And then all of a sudden, you know, CDC, NIH, everybody's trying to play catch up because the administration was not forward thinking. And of course, now the fallback, Kurt, is, well, this is really Obama's fault in the first place, because they put in imposed regulations that required CDC to do X as opposed to Y. Well, the regulations that even come close to what he's referring to were formulated under the Bush administration. There were no such regulations that precluded any type of testing or formulation of testing by the Obama administration, because even the CDC saying, we don't know what the president's talking about. How will this virus and the way the administration played it impact this race? By the summer, no one's sick, there are no more deaths, everything's fine. Do we forget, or does this have the potential to have a lingering impact and effect?
You know, I really think that this really is Donald Trump's Hurricane Katrina moment. And we have seen over time how the Bush administration's mishandling of the response to Hurricane Katrina has been affixed to his legacy. And by virtue of the way that Trump is talking about this in real time, he is setting an impossible standard that the government simply isn't equipped to meet. I mean, he was on Sean Hannity last night telling people that if you're sick, just go to work,
right?
You know, and so
right.
It's like not out of context. That's what he said. Go to work. If you have the flu, come to work. Do your job.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like you can't reconcile the. On one hand, Trump says, there's nothing to worry about. We got it under control." And then in the same day, breaking news alerts of this person died of coronavirus. New coronavirus. They just found a new case in the suburbs of Nashville, Tennessee today.
Yeah.
There's another case in San Francisco. It doesn't align with the facts on the ground. And
the dial,
you know,
as we talk, and the dial, Kurt, as we're talking at this moment, is down 1,000 points again.
Again, yeah, the markets have a lot of confidence in Trump's nonsense. I mean, this is also, I think, the cumulative effect of when you have a president who lies about crowd sizes at inaugurations, who redraws the hurricane path with a Sharpie on a map, who even Republicans concede that this guy isn't truthful.
Right.
Now, they may be okay with him lying, but they still concede, well, he's not really truthful about stuff. And there is no reservoir of trust or goodwill with the American people for a guy who's told more than 11,000 lies while in office.
Right.
And now we're talking about something that hits people where they live. Everybody knows what it's like to have the cold and the flu. Everybody knows someone who has the cold or the flu. And now we're talking about an elevated measure of that, where people are dying. There are people who are scared. Everyone has seen walking around somewhere, someone walk around with a mask over their face.
Right.
Some, you know, I was at Target the other day, and all the bleach was sold. All anti-flu medicine was gone. It was an empty shelf. That's creepy as hell, honestly, to see. Empty shelves at grocery stores.
Yeah.
You know, that's the nightmare. And so the reality on the ground is so drastically different than the fiction that is coming out of the president's mouth every day, that it's going to cause him, I think, a tremendous amount of harm, because what it does is it makes the case for why we need competent change. And the person that benefits the most is Joe Biden, say what you want about Joe. He's been in government a long time. He was Barack Obama's vice president. He knows how government works, how government functions. He was there during the Ebola crisis and played a prominent role in helping navigate that whole deal.
Right.
So that just reinforces, I think, people's appetite for, well, we don't need the Donald Trump of the left and Bernie, but just returning to basic core competency, there's something to that.
Well, and I think that just makes the point that I've been saying for a while, that this election is not about policy. It is not about ideology. It's not about philosophy. It is about, and fundamentally remains about one thing. Who can take me off the crazy? I'm tired. Mm-hmm. I'm tired of this crack pipe. I just want a nice, you know, slow roll and not worry about crazy anymore. And I think that's...
I mean, wouldn't it be amazing if you had a president where you didn't read his tweets every day,
right,
like on air, right, like to talk about as a topic of conversation?
Exactly. Well, and that's exactly right. The level of intrusion into our personal lives by this one person, irrespective of his role as president, is just so overwhelming, and now I think so complete for a lot of Americans that the challenge for Democrats is to show. And I think this was Elizabeth Warren's part. Yeah, you had a plan for everything, but how you would defeat Donald Trump. And I think that was more than anything else, the edge for a lot, and has been the edge for a lot of voters out there, is how, because you need to put together a broad coalition right now, Democrats. You just do. You've got to hold your Bernie bros in place. You've got to consolidate your center left. And then you've got to reach out and pull center-right Republicans and independents away from those. And, yes, even those folks who stand with Trump who are kind of looking across saying, well, is there a cavalry coming or am I just going to stay here? That's going to be the space that the Democratic nominee is going to have to fill completely and then do it in a way in which they win in November. And to your point, not just look at the presidency, but then also look at governing effectively by having a Democratic Senate. There are only six seats you need, and that dynamic is going to be important. And focusing on the right thing, I think, will get you there. Kurt Bardella.
Well, this is why I think – oh, sorry. Oh, so the last thought. This is the reason why I think that one of the things that Joe Biden talks about, and he gets hit from the left about this, but he talks about the need to work with Republicans when this is all done to actually get things done. And I want your listeners to understand something. There still is an appetite for bipartisanship in Washington. They may not be able to show it publicly on cable TV, right, and on the
true
trail. But I was at an event last night that saw for 2 hours, you had Speaker Pelosi, Kevin McCarthy, Steve Scalise, Steny Hoyer sitting next to each other for 2 hours. It was a tribute to Garth Brooks, who received the Gershwin Prize for a popular song, a very prestigious songwriter's award that is handed out by the Library of Congress. And you saw a room full of people who on TV every day we tear into each other, but were there together in the spirit of the traditions of Congress and experiencing something, and it was positive and it was fun. You literally had, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Kevin McCarthy singing along to Friends in Low Places together, for crying out loud.
Right.
That's the real Washington, not this aberration we see play out on TV every day, but what I saw last night at this great event. And I think that Biden is very smart and astute in talking about that. And there is an appetite, particularly for middle of the road voters, whether it's center right or center left, of people who want to come back to that period of time.
I had forgotten, and so this now gives me even more incentive to get your ass back on this podcast where we can do less politics and more culture, because you are the country music guru. I forgot about that little piece.
The other side of my life.
I listened to you, break down the whole country music genre and the background. Folks, it is, you're good. When we do that one, yeah, it's going to be something special. So that is, you don't understand. This Asian brother got country. Let me just tell you, he's got country in him. So this works. This works. Kurt Bardella, you're one of the best out there, man. It is a pleasure to call you a colleague and friend. He's a Morning Joe and NBC News Think contributor and certainly does a great service as a member of the USA Today's Board of Contributors. Thank you so much, buddy, for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you, my friend. It's an honor.
Absolutely. Well, that wraps up this conversation, folks. You know we're going to bring you more excitement and a lot of good stuff out there. Y'all just keep making it happen, and we keep talking about it. We also have another little feature that we've launched, which I think you'll like. It's called Quick Take, where each week, maybe even a couple of days, we're going to give you a quick take on some exciting stuff, whether it's culture, whether it's politics, whether it's whatever. We want to give you a quick thought or take on that and bring some new, fresh voices to you. So look out for the quick take storyline coming to you as well. Don't forget, download us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts on. This is Michael Steele on the Michael Steele Podcast. Peace out.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.